and thank you for joining us in Mapping the Zone, a podcast usually dedicated to a highly fixated review of large, dense books, specifically the works in context of Thomas Pynchon. My name is Cody. I'm one of the co-hosts.
I'm Kate.
And I'm the slowest, Will.
I'm gonna leave that dramatic pause in the edit.
Wasn't expecting you to ask to introduce all three of us.
Wasn't expecting to either. I just kept reading the script and that's what it was. So here we are. So this is the one of our bonus episodes that we're doing while we're on break after finishing Vineland and waiting to get started on Bleeding Edge. So the general idea, kind of like last time, each of us is going to bring a different media item in to talk about, whether it's a book or a film or an album, something that we're just really into and want to talk about with the others. My episode is going to be focused on the film Inland Empire by David Lynch. I kind of want to also kind of cover his general work, but I'm focusing specifically on that film. It's actually his last film that came out, 2005. He hasn't really done anything since then other than the Twin Peaks Return, which, depending on who you talk to, is an 18-hour long film. Inland Empire is a very unique film in a very unique filmography. And so I'm pretty excited to talk about it with y'all. Before I get going on it though, I wanted to kind of get y'all's familiarity with Lynch. I know we've talked a lot about, specifically Twin Peaks. So I know, Kate is pretty familiar with his work, but Will, I'm not really sure how much of his, work you're familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of the very little that I've seen of his work.
Okay.
I have seen the first two seasons of Twin Peaks, and I think I kind of have the basic opinion of really enjoying everything except for the soap opera stuff. But I do understand what he was going for, and on some level, it's fun. And beyond that, I honestly, I haven't seen any of his feature-length films. What I have seen is many of his short projects on his YouTube channel.
Those are
and,
fun.
One of my favorite things of the, is it 5 years old now? Past few years. What Did Jack Do? Which, if no one's aware of it, is David Lynch interrogating a monkey for 30 minutes on Netflix. It's high quality. Anyway, I'm a big fan of what he tends to talk about and create art about, but I'm not very aware of his actual films.
Okay.
I've actually seen everything other than Inland Empire.
Okay.
It was just a case where I had a hard time finding a place to watch it, and just at that time in my life, a 3-hour film, I just could not stomach at the time. Obviously now that's fairly commonplace, but was not when that film was released. So
yeah,
I just kind of missed it. But I've seen everything else that he's done, and I struggle to think of anything that I dislike other than the character of James in Twin Peaks.
I mean, that's the general kind of consensus. A lot of people
I would love it if he disappeared from that entire show. Because he's really the problem in season two. If I ever have to watch that scene where he plays guitar again, I might walk into the lake, because I can't do it. But I'm a very big fan of David Lynch. I similar to Will, I like the things that he decides to make art about. Mm-hmm. His short films are also very interesting. So is his paintings. His paintings are also very interesting.
Yeah.
Big fan of the thematic territory that he's kind of worked throughout his career. And I'm curious to learn more about this particular movie.
Cool. So I'll kind of give a background for listeners who aren't really familiar with Lynch, and the particular reason I chose him as a filmmaker, and the reason we talk about him so much, or at least I talk about him so much on this show, I do genuinely think he is probably one of the most Pynchon-esque filmmakers. I think his work helped me get into Pynchon. I've been watching his films and Twin Peaks since my sophomore year of high school. I think I saw Lost Highway was the first movie I watched of his, and was absolutely terrified by Robert Blake's character in that film. I still am. He's a horrifying presence throughout that movie, but a very interesting one. And I was just hooked on his work since then. But I feel like with him and with Pynchon, they both tend to get kind of pigeonholed as these really obtuse artists that are, you know, making this super difficult or hard to parse work that is intentionally challenging and makes it too much, you know, quote unquote work to actually understand what they're doing, which I genuinely dislike that categorization. I think that both of them do make very abstract art.
It's true.
But I don't think it's impossible to decode. I think what it is, so going back to Inland Empire, I saw this film when it came out in 2005. I skipped a class at college to go up to Austin to watch it. And a couple of friends of mine wanted to go despite actively hating everything he had done. And I was confused
why did they want to go?
No idea. I have no idea. But it was a free ride to Austin. My car wasn't working very well. So I was like, cool, I'll buy y'all's tickets. I'll buy you guys some popcorn. And, you know, you can do whatever you want. So I was explaining to them, we had this conversation in the ride up to Austin, because it's about a 2-hour drive from San Antonio to Austin. So we had this conversation. I was kind of explaining to them, you know, their main complaint was kind of what I had said a minute ago about it. You know, it's intentionally confusing, or it's too weird and out there. And the way I put it to them was, with a lot of filmmakers and authors, they are essentially presenting you with a story that is, you know, sort of a puzzle that, and you watch as the film progresses or as the story goes along, you watch them put those pieces together and complete the story. Someone like Lynch is essentially dumping the puzzle pieces on the table and saying, have a good time. And it's up to you to figure out how everything fits together. And I think that makes for a much more rewarding experience and allows for a lot more rewatchability, or in Pynchon's case, a lot of rereadability. You can go back and find different through ways to get from one point of the story to another, or how a character relates to another character. It's a lot of different layers that are going on at the same time, but there is, underneath all of that, there is a coherent story being told. You just have to allow yourself to really engage with the film or the book on that level. And I think that's the main reason I think a lot of people are so put off by these kinds of artists, is that it is, you have to do a little bit of work. And I think that as a society, we've kind of grown to the point where it's just, most people just want to sit and stare at a screen and have a story told at them. Something like this, where it's a very kind of fragmented or fractured sort of narrative, is too much. You know, it's they don't, you know, it's the same people who don't want to watch a subtitled film because they don't want to read. Which I, when I worked at Barnes & Noble, was a complaint I had leveraged at so many films that I was trying to push in people's hands that it drove me insane.
Yeah, nowadays it's commonplace for people of younger generations to just have subtitles on all the time.
Yeah, I know. My kids don't like watching things without the subtitles on, and it's like, okay, that's fine, but it's weird. But anyway, so Lynch, getting back to his work, has always been this sort of surreal filmmaker. His first film, Eraserhead, was a very haunting and very dark sort of story about, if you really boil it down, about fatherhood, about becoming a parent and the kind of fears that come along with that. It is a very interesting film to watch, especially for a debut filmmaker. It's a very powerful film, and it is showcasing someone who really has a control over what he's doing and understands what he's trying to do. The score for that film is incredible. It's on, I'm pretty sure it's on most of the streaming services by now. It is a just hellscape of noise and ambient sounds that is unlike anything else as far as film scores. I think it really kind of set the tone, especially for a film from 1977, for what wouldn't really be done in filmmaking for a much longer time after that. I think we're finally starting now to get a lot of film scores that are more interested in playing with dissonance and noise and bizarre ambient sound. And I think Eraserhead's score was a pretty big influence on a lot of those. His career kind of continued. He did some bigger films with The Elephant Man and Dune. Dune, which was a huge, huge flop for a number of reasons. There's a really good book that just came out about the filmmaking process of that, and it's a great read if anybody's interested. If you've seen the movie, it offers a lot of really cool behind the scenes stuff and a really good understanding of what happened to make that film spiral out of control the way it did. But that let him kind of get a taste of the Hollywood machine and definitely left a sour taste in his mouth. So he moved on and started doing what he wanted to do. And we got films like Blue Velvet, which is an incredible film, one of his best. Mm-hmm. I think most people would, you know, pretty firmly agree with that. And then he continued, you know, making others, you know, he made Twin Peaks in the late 80s and early 90s. He did Lost Highway later in the 90s. He did a Disney film, which is highly underrated. And a lot of people haven't seen it. It's called The Straight Story, about a veteran who learns his brother's dying and takes a tractor to go and visit him because he doesn't have a driver's license, so he has no other way to drive. Based on a true story, it's an absolutely heartbreaking film. And it's a beautiful, it's a family film by David Lynch, which is a sentence that you normally would not hear. But it's an incredible film. If no one has seen it, please go and watch that one because it's amazing. And then arguably his most well-known film was Mulholland Drive, which is also probably one of his best films. I would definitely say it's one of the ones I've watched more than the others. It kind of is the biggest thing that he has done in his career aside from Twin Peaks. I think more people know him for Mulholland Drive as a film than pretty much anything else he's done. It's, I think, the only of his films that Roger Ebert liked, which he used to use Ebert's distaste for his films as marketing on his film posters, which is something I always loved. And then after Mulholland Drive was this film, Inland Empire, in 2005. And this one is really, you know, for an experimental filmmaker such as David Lynch, this is probably his most ambitious film. It is entirely shot on digital video, handheld camcorders. So it has this really grainy texture throughout the whole thing. He's getting these incredibly close-up shots throughout a lot of the film. And it really makes for almost a very claustrophobic feeling film. You know, a lot of the kind of horror and strangeness that he works with is usually built around ambience and atmosphere. And this film is just full of it. And the ability for him to really move around with this camera in a way that, you know, a normal studio camera would not be able to move, even with today's, you know, kind of more mobile cameras. You know, this is something that, you know, again, you're holding it in your hand, in one hand, and able to move through and kind of work with these actors and get unconventional shots that really lend a lot to the way that this story is told. On top of that, he did not have a completed script at the time he made this film. Essentially what he was doing was having everyone who he wanted to shoot with show up on set that day, wherever they were filming. He would hand them whatever he had written for that time, and they would just go off of that. So whereas in most of his films before, a lot of the actors who were working with him would say, you know, I have no idea what the hell this was about. But it was a fun time to make it. This one had more of that than any other because he literally was just, you know, essentially handing people their lines the day of. They didn't have time to rehearse necessarily. So that also, again, adds to this very weird sort of dreamy kind of feel that this that runs through this film. On top of all of that, the way this story is structured, even for a David Lynch film, is very interesting. It is, a lot of Lynch's films are these very kind of fragmented stories where there is a linear story being told. You're just getting different parts of it from different viewpoints at different times, and it's jumping around chronologically. With this one, I remember when I saw this in the theater, we saw it at Alamo Drafthouse, and I had took one of the little papers that you would write your order on, and I was taking notes throughout the movie, like different things that I was kind of catching on to.
Might be the nerdiest thing I've ever heard in my life.
That's exactly what the people who were with me were saying. I thought, what the hell are you writing? I was like, notes. But one of the things I wrote, and I wish I'd kept that paper because it would be interesting to go through all of that again. But I do remember writing down Russian nesting doll, because that's what this story felt like. So it's essentially, you kind of have this, it's almost the same story being told in different layers at different times, with a through line of essentially a character that's almost being brought back into each of these stories. So, you know, rather than it being a similar story told at different times, this has the same, essentially has the same character in each of these times and each of these stories, but they're all tied together through a number of the characters that are in there and the ways in which they interact. I don't want to get too granular about what the story is about, because I think it's really something that you have to kind of experience and see. But it is sort of a Russian nesting doll, is I think the best way I can describe the way these stories are set into each other, and kind of come together and expand back out again. On top of that, Lynch is, if you're familiar with his work, you know that he loves a lot of old-timey things, and especially he loves old films. Inland Empire is essentially his version of Sunset Boulevard and Ingmar Bergman's Persona, which, again, if you haven't seen either of those films, go watch those as well, because those are excellent. Persona might be my favorite Bergman film. Kind of depends on when I'm thinking about it. But so there are actually direct references to Sunset Boulevard that are peppered throughout the film as well. So that's kind of another little element that he's put into there. But it is, I think when, I don't remember where someone mentioned that online a while back, and that's where I was like, holy shit, I hadn't really thought about that, but that's absolutely accurate. This is essentially what Sunset Boulevard was. Just
so I'm familiar with Persona. I don't know what Sunset Boulevard is.
So Sunset Boulevard was, before I say who, I think Billy Wilder directed it. Let me just be sure of that. Billy Wilder. Yeah. So 1950 film by Billy Wilder. It is essentially about an actress who has aged out of Hollywood and of the studio storytelling system. So they have kind of written her off and aren't giving her any starring roles anymore. She finally lands a sort of dream role that she wants and becomes consumed by the character that she's playing, so much so that she is essentially absorbed into the story and becomes that character and can't discern between what's real and what's in the film. And okay. It plays with her kind of delusion and her inability to separate those two realities. That's essentially the same thing that's going on in Inland Empire. So essentially what's happening is you have the main character played by Laura Dern, who absolutely crushes everything in this film. She is so, so good. And the fact that she didn't even get nominated for an Oscar, and I'll get into that later, because Lynch did some weird stuff with that too.
He did. But
it's really a shame. This may be her best performance, and I love Laura Dern. She's a phenomenal actress. She is playing an actress named Nikki Grace, who is kind of a fading star, manages to land this role in what could be a really big film for her. Her and her co-star start having an affair. She starts becoming consumed by the part to the point where she can't tell if she's in the film acting or if she's, you know, just herself, Nikki Grace. Eventually, as the film moves on, she becomes so lost in the character that she is essentially living inside of the story. So now we've gone from this sort of larger picture of her making the film into her being in the film, wherein, as she's told at the start of production on the film, it is a remake of an old film that's also a sort of retelling of an old folk tale. And so as the film's progressing, it's also bringing itself into both the remake of the original film and the folk tale in which it is based. So it's at the same time playing through all these different iterations of the same story and how her character is moving through each of those stories and how that relates to how she's moving in the larger frame of her as an actress in the real world. So there's a lot of through lines that kind of connect all of these, they are essentially played, if I'm not mistaken, I meant to rewatch this before we did this. I just haven't had time. So the last time I saw it was, I think, last year. I'm pretty sure each of those characters who have a through line throughout this that connect everything are also played by the same actor. So that lends to this sort of surrealist way that this is all working about. And it also becomes more and more dreamlike as we get deeper into it. So it's kind of, for lack of a better description, it's sort of like if Inception was inside of itself. Okay. So it's just dropping into these different layers of this whole thing. But it's really incredible how even a storytelling like this is hard to do and keep it all working and keeping the plot moving and not dragging at any point. For a 3-hour film running with this many different sort of stories within stories, it never takes its foot off the gas. It is constantly going. It is constantly moving and keeping the viewer engaged with it, trying to simultaneously keep you aware of what's going on, but also trying to disorient you at the same time, so that just like Laura Dern's character is having trouble discerning between what is and isn't real, at some point as a viewer, you start getting lost in that as well. So it really, that kind of adds to all of that. So there also, for Will, you mentioned you've watched a lot of his short films. I don't know if you ever saw the one called Rabbits.
So he actually, I think he ended up making, he made a lot of Rabbits, short shorts. Yeah.
So Rabbits, I don't know, plays into this film. So all of them actually tie into it. They're all, okay. I think he pulled them directly into the film. I don't think he reshot them. I think they were all just brought back into the film. So those characters tie into the film as well.
That's cool.
It really is cool to see, especially once you kind of put together what their role in all of this is. So at the end of the day, it's with most of Lynch's work, I think there are a lot of kind of commonalities about what kind of themes he's exploring and the sort of stories he's telling. And a lot of them deal with the abuse of women by men in power, or men who have some sort of power over the female character that's in the film. And this is kind of essentially playing with that same idea. So there's a lot of, I feel like this is probably also why he stopped making films after this, is that this film feels sort of like the culmination of everything he has been doing up to this point. And it is disappointing because it's 20 years later and I would really love another Lynch film. I did love Twin Peaks: The Return. I'm not going to say it's an 18-hour film, because it wasn't that. But I would love at least one more film from him. But if we don't get one, this is a fantastic one to go out on. As with a lot of his other films, it also has a lot of interesting cameos in it. Diane Lane pops in, William H. Macy, Terry Crews is in it. He brings back Naomi Watts and Laura Herring from Mulholland Drive. Justin Theroux, who he worked with a little bit, he's in there as a pretty main character. Harry Dean Stanton is in it. It's an absolutely incredible film. And I think for anyone who has watched a lot of Lynch films and hasn't seen this one, I think this is a fantastic one to watch. I don't necessarily think this would be a good starting point for someone who is not familiar with his work. But it could, depending on what you like in films, it could be a good primer for his work, because, you know, as I said, it does cover a lot of what he has been doing as a filmmaker since the late 70s. I would say if you're not familiar with his films at all, I would probably recommend starting with something like Mulholland Drive or Blue Velvet, and then kind of, you know, going from there.
I think everyone should start with David Lynch Cook's Quinoa, and then
I think that's an important,
shit, I forgot, yeah, important piece all of the film canon. I wonder if that's still available.
It's on YouTube.
Find it and I'll put the link in the show notes. That was, holy shit, I forgot about that one. That was good. But yeah, he is, and the soundtrack for this one, Lynch also does a really good job of putting together soundtracks, not just scores, but the actual like music, like songs that are in the film. I will say that the song Locomotion by Little Eva from like 1956 or whatever it was, that one pops in here, and it seems really weird when you first watch it, but it ends up making sense once you kind of start putting the pieces together. So, but it also has a lot of his actual, like, his music. So Lynch started making his own songs. I think his first album came out in the early 2000s, like 2001 or 2 or something like that. And this one has some of his own compositions on there, which are really pretty good. And the couple of solo records that he's put out have been pretty interesting as well. So if you haven't checked those out, I would recommend those as well. But yeah, that's my pitch on Inland Empire. If y'all have any questions or thoughts or anything.
So I have a slight refinement, I guess, of a question you already answered, which was, as somebody new to his films, should I start with this? But my further question is, would you say that this movie might be better viewed as the culmination of seeing his other films, you know, whether that be all of them or just a selection of them? Or do you think that after you kind of get your bearings with David Lynch, that anybody could enjoy Inland Empire?
I think it's more of the latter. I do think some could come away from it with as a first Lynch film and enjoy it. But I do think it helps to sort of have somewhat of a background with at least his more well-known films. I would say, really, if anything, before watching this one, I would recommend watching Eraserhead and Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway for sure. I think those are the three that are closest in the way that the story is told and the way that the film is made. I know a lot of people would point to Blue Velvet as being, you know, a sort of quintessential of his films, and I would definitely not disagree with that. But that is a much more linear story, and it is not as surreal as this one is. So I would say, to kind of bounce off of that, if the surreal and weird Lynch is not your jam, that's where I would recommend, you know, maybe check out Blue Velvet, Straight Story. Even Twin Peaks is a little bit more linear, I think, and a little bit more easily digestible.
Just watch like episodes like 9 through 15 of the second season.
Oh my God.
It's the most straightforward David Lynch content you can possibly get.
It's certainly the most devoid of Lynch that Twin Peaks ever was. What a spectacular nosedive in an otherwise phenomenal show.
Yeah,
but they
killed
did. They did kill
the show.
It really did. But they did. They did recover from it. I don't know how they managed to come back like that. But when it picks itself back up, when Lynch came back, he was making Wild at Heart at the time, and he kind of abandoned the show and pissed off pretty much everyone who worked on the show, which is why a lot of them didn't come back for Fire Walk with Me.
Mm.
Basically, yeah, from about episode 16, 17, once the Wyndham Earl plotline of season 2 kicks on, it really kind of course corrects and becomes what it was trying to be. Honestly, with that, though, a lot of the blame lands on ABC for forcing them to reveal the killer when that was never the intention of Lynch or Mark Frost at all. That was really, as Lynch described it, that was killing the goose that laid the golden egg. So it kind of, you know, it became what it was. But to go back, I totally forgot to, so regarding the Laura Dern situation. So Laura Dern, like I said, phenomenal in this film. She's essentially playing four versions of the same character. Absolutely no recognition from the Academy Awards, which no surprise there. They generally don't like anything Lynch does. In what might be the most Lynchian thing he's ever done, he sat on the side of, I'm pretty sure it was Mulholland Drive, and with a live cow in a chair. Lynch was in a chair, not the cow. I should clarify that. With a big sign that basically was saying something to the effect of, like, nominate Laura Dern, Laura Dern should have won or should have been nominated or something to that effect. He sat outside for a day with a cow and a sign saying that Laura Dern should have been nominated for this film.
And even that could not have convinced the Academy to go for it.
I'm curious who won that year.
That'd be the 2006 Oscars, because it's always a year ahead.
Oh, that was the year fucking Crash won Best Picture. Fuck that movie. Absolute piece of shit. Reese Witherspoon won for Walk the Line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
She was very good in that movie.
She was. I Laura Dern was better, but that's neither here nor there. But let's... Fucking Crash, Jesus, goddamn Christ. And that beat out Brokeback Mountain, Capote, Good Night and Good Luck, and Munich. And that says a lot more about the Oscars than anything else I think has ever said about the Oscars.
It's like that year The Artist won Best Picture. Black and white silent movie that nobody saw other than Hollywood people who like to jerk themselves off about how important their industry is. Yeah, there's been a couple of years where just the choices for any Oscar, let alone Best Picture, have just been mind-boggling. Like when Green Book won. What?
Yeah, Jesus.
Gotta love plurality voting, right?
It's so fun.
So, yeah, at the end of the day, go watch this film if you haven't seen it. But maybe watch a couple other Lynch films before you watch it, just to kind of give yourself a good primer on it.
Why is it 3 hours long?
Because it needs to be.
Okay, but why? That's what I want to know.
Because honestly, there is a lot going on, and it does seem like that would be a bloated runtime. But I don't. I think given the number of stories that are happening at the same time and the number of characters that are coming in and out, I think cutting too much of it would have been detrimental to the film's ability to tell the story it was trying to tell. I certainly, like, 3 hours is a long time for a movie. Don't get me wrong. Like, I like a lot of long movies and I could find a lot to trim in those movies sometimes, but I struggle to find what I would cut from this. I do think it earns its runtime.
Okay. That's always my biggest concern whenever a movie is real long.
That's why I haven't been able to rewatch it over the last year. I just haven't had time. I got sidetracked with Girl Scout cookies, and then Final Fantasy VII Rebirth came out, and I've been consumed by that for the last week. So,
just eating cookies while playing Final Fantasy VII.
I mean, what else am I gonna do?
I was going to make a joke about some food they eat in Final Fantasy, but I don't know enough about Final Fantasy to make that joke. I don't know.
There's no part of the game where they eat really. So burgers, they eat burgers. Sure. I don't know.
Burgers. Well, I mean, like if it was a Kingdom Hearts reference, you could say like the sea salt ice cream. I don't know if there's an analog to that in Final Fantasy.
The guys that made, the director of Kingdom Hearts is the director for the remake series of Final Fantasy VII. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah.
You could chomp on some Phoenix down, I guess.
I guess so. I mean, that seems wasteful if I'm not dying and needing to be brought back all the time, though.
So isn't it canonical that chocobos are eaten? Like
it happens in Rebirth.
Chicken.
It does happen in Rebirth. Yeah.
So, eat some chocobo, I guess.
Is this the nerdiest we've ever gotten on this show?
I don't think so.
It's probably not, but it might be up there.
If you, the listener, have a different point in time where we've gotten nerdier, please write in and let us know.
This is a podcast about an author who includes, you know, little sing songs in his books about science and politics.
This is true.
I think that the baseline of nerdiness is astronomically high.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, just to go out of your way to listen to a show that the average episode of is 2.5 hours about this one guy. Yeah, that's for sure.
Well, that's all I have for mine. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you on whatever next week's episode is.
Bye.
Bye.
Love you.
I'm going to leave that in too.